Welcome to the Manhattan Institute's Innovative Ideas Podcast. Joining us this afternoon is Peter Pitts, the president and co-founder of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, as well as a partner director of global healthcare at Porter Novelli. From 2002 to 2004, Peter was FDA's associate commissioner for external relations, serving as the senior communications and policy advisor to the Commission on Drug Administration. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Peter, on Tuesday, we saw the Republicans take control of the House of Representatives and gain 6 seats in the Senate. What implications is this going to have for healthcare reform initiatives and healthcare issues in general, particularly as they relate to your area of expertise, the FDA?
The flip of the House and the addition of seats in the Senate is going to have a profound effect on how healthcare issues and FDA reform is handled in Congress. There are 3 big ticket items. First, obviously, is the fact there'll be brand new members who will need to be educated on these very complicated and very arcane, in some instances, information relative to FDA and the healthcare reform bill, which no one really understood when they wrote it for it in the first place, and they obviously paid the price. Second will be new staffers who will have the opportunity to brief these members, really for the first time in their career, make a big difference as to who gets the ear of the elected member. And thirdly, and probably most visibly, are that some of the seats of the chair will shift. Henry Waxman, who's the chair of Energy and Commerce, obviously will now be on the minority side. Similarly, Rosa DeLauro at Ag Probes and people like Pete Stark on Ways and Means. And these are the guys who really set the agenda and wield the gavel. So there'll be a lot of hearings, different witnesses, I think better witnesses to discuss things from a, shall we say, less anti-industry, more public health perspective.
So from that perspective, what are some of the key issues that are likely to come up and be of concern and get more of a pro-innovation, pro-patient perspective from Republicans in Congress? Let's talk about a couple of issues I think you're very familiar with. Review times for new drug applications and the blizzard of safety warnings and safety letters that are now coming out of FDA.
Well, I think you'll have a Congress, or certainly in the House, you'll have chairmen and chairwomen that will want to have hearings to discuss not just how the FDA is being policemen, but also how they are cooperating with industry and how some of the FDA actions may actually be deleterious to the public health. Writing more warning letters on promotion, sending out more safety alerts, that's clearly a good thing if you want to get media attention. But when it comes to actually advancing the public health, not so much. And I think that new members of Congress will want to know not just what the FDA is doing to punish industry, but rather what's FDA doing to collaborate with industry to advance public health in a variety of ways. Relative to drug safety, there were many codicils within the FDA Amendments Act, the DAW, that are now coming to fruition, seeing that there's some significant unintended consequences. For example, the regular communications about early safety signals. And while that sounded like a good idea, what's resulting is there isn't any more safety, but there's a lot of people being scared into noncompliance, a lot of additional 1-800 lawyer ads on television. And I think a new Congress, and especially a Republican House, is going to want to talk about how to make sure that these pieces of legislation that were put into place to make things better actually do that rather than simply be there to punish industry and reward tort lawyers.
One of the concerns here is, do we have a good pipeline, a robust, fast-moving, and hopefully less expensive pipeline for moving new products to market? I think a lot of industry observers have talked, at least since the mid-1990s, that the cost of bringing new products to market has skyrocketed, with the number of new drug applications and the number of new products in the market has been relatively stagnant or even dropping in some cases. For things like, as you pointed out, collaborative issues like the Reagan-Udall Foundation that was supposed to get funding in the last PDUFA reauthorization, is that one of the things that might get a more friendly hearing from Congress?
I think it will absolutely do so. I think that this new Congress is going to be very interested in new and innovative ways to bring products to market and to understand their safety and efficacy in a more 21st century manner. Mrs. DeLauro, for some reason, believed that biomarkers were evil and could actually bring unsafe drugs to market, even though that Francis Collins, the head of the NIH, understands that they're almost miraculous in their capabilities. Ultimately, what I think the Reagan-Udall Center will be able to do is initially allow industry to fail faster so that more money can be reinvested into molecules that move forward successfully. With the money that was earmarked in FDA for the Reagan-Udall Center, I believe the FDA really can get a running start on working with industry on developing these tools for 21st century science.
And circling back a little bit towards healthcare reform, comparative effectiveness research, a number of agencies got quite a bit of funding through the Stimulus Act back in 2009, I think over $1 billion, if I recall correctly. And then the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act also authorized the creation of the Independent Payment Advisory Board for Medicare, another way for comparative effectiveness issues to be raised for healthcare. And particularly going to have an impact on the pharmaceutical industry because the way that the bill is structured, providers are protected from IPAB for the first several years the program is in effect. So despite the fact that drugs are only about 10% of U.S. healthcare costs and many ways are tools that help reduce overall healthcare spending, they're going to be on the front line for
cuts
right away.
I think that kind of taking it in a linear fashion, in the very first stimulus package, there was $1.1 billion, billion with a B, give it to the Agency for Health Quality and Research, ARC, to do comparative. Actually, the bill likes a clinical effectiveness, which is fine, you can call it whatever you want, but at the end of the day, I think the political philosophy behind that earmark was cost effectiveness, kind of like what NICE is doing in the UK. I think that a Republican Congress is going to look at this money, and they're going to look at the work that ARC does, and they're going to say, why are we spending this money on studies that once they're done, even if they're done properly, are out of date by 5 years when they're completed? So I think it was the $1.1 billion was almost a gift to those people who believe we ultimately need to get to a single-payer system. A lot of the codicils of Obamacare, in my opinion at least, were slippery slopes to a more socialized, government-run healthcare system. When it comes to things like IPAP, it's very important to understand that in the previous iteration of MedPAC, the MedPAC recommendations were not at all binding. A bunch of smart people got together, made recommendations, generally they were ignored. Under the new law, recommendations that are made by this committee are binding, and these cuts will take place unless Congress acts to stop them. And the likelihood of Congress actually taking time out of its busy schedule to act on very complicated medical healthcare technology effectiveness issues is slim to none. So I think what you'll see are hearings in the House, certainly, on not just things like IPAB and ARC, but all the other various kind of almost hidden codicils that provide us kind of that back door to a single-payer system.
And the concern here, even as science is moving us towards a more personalized environment for healthcare, where medicines will be targeted to your or I, our own genetic background, we're going to have these one-size-fits-all studies. They're going to look at entire populations and say, you know, up or down, this drug or that drug. Not really the right way to proceed, given the way the science is going.
Right. Well, you have things like the KD trial, the OLHET trial, the STAR-D trial, these very large government-funded comparative effectiveness trials that ultimately are horribly flawed in their design. When they're done, the best practice of clinical medicine has zoomed past it. But I think the real key here is, as you said, is, you know, how it's going to be used for a reimbursement perspective. In the current iteration of healthcare reform and also in the stimulus bill, it was very clear that the clinical effectiveness studies, for example, that ARC would field, could not be used by CMS in reimbursement decisions. And I think that's clearly, if not a lie, certainly a wink and a nod to until you need to. I think at the end of the day, you said 10%. You know, I think the overall spend is 11.5% in this country on drugs. Only 8% and change are spent on patent innovator drugs. And to try to, in the century of genomics, to say that we can do large population studies and decide which drug is right for everybody with the same condition is just foolish. I don't think anybody believes that except members of Congress who are kind of sold it as a bill of goods, as a talking point. And one of the guys in administration right now, Dr. Don Berwick, who's the CMS administrator, who I said was never confirmed through the Senate, and his recess appointment is good only through 2011, is a big proponent of a NHS NICE-style single-payer system, just as that system is falling apart now. So I think that we'll see Dr. Berwick, who didn't get a chance to defend himself for appointment, will be called on the Hill quite often now to testify relative to the aspects of Obamacare that might lead to a NHS-style system.
And we should say that the NICE system in the UK is actually being dismantled there by the government that's in power now.
Well, that's exactly right. We think a lot of people, certainly in certain political philosophies, believe that healthcare in Europe is just like Michael Moore told them it was in Sicca, which is perfect. And you talk to most people, and they think that there's one system in Europe which clearly is farcical. And you ask them, would you prefer to have universal care or government care? They go, oh, no, we don't want government care, we want universal care, like in Europe, where it's free. And clearly, as systems like the NHS are collapsing almost under their own weight, we need to look at both the good aspects of that and the bad aspects of that. So I think you'll see a lot of hearings discussing both the pros and the cons of various European-style systems.
Just to close, do you think there's a kind of a pivot choice here, whether or not healthcare reforms are going to be oriented towards innovation and moving towards more personalized therapies that can hopefully improve outcomes and lower costs, or this one-size-fits-all, that there's this clash of visions now we're going to see it play out over the next couple of years?
Well, I think you're going to have, certainly in the House, hearings that are going to be structured in a way to support the concept of personalized medicine and spending upfront relative to prevention of all kinds. Because at the end of the day, if you view yourself as the major payer, which government is, and governments want to save money, then you have a cost-centric system, as opposed to a longer-term patient-centric system where a patient is kept healthier earlier, which ultimately is how we're going to save our system by reducing costs.
Terrific message to end on. Peter, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.